Excellent. Great pronunciation of my last name, by the way. That's not an easy feat for most people. I'm very happy to have this slot on a Friday morning after the barbecue, because I want to talk about something a little bit lighter. I would encourage you to interrupt me and ask questions as I go. I plan, as a spoiler, I'll cover two, maybe three different things. And so just ask on the topic if there's anything that you would like to ask, okay? I wanted to talk about the quantum cartpool, or perhaps, as we'll see later, maybe not so quantum cartpool. But I promised yesterday that I would do some introducing of myself, and I thought, why not introduce applied quantum algorithms and Leiden University? Who of you have heard of Leiden University? Okay, good, because I just had the question, is that this is a new one for me. It's in the Netherlands, about an hour south of Amsterdam. It's right next to Delft. Maybe you've heard of Delft. At the university, there's this applied quantum algorithms group, consists of these five people. It's about 40 people in total, PhD students, postdocs included, with the sort of idea that it will cover the full quantum pipeline, from circuit cutting, where especially Veytan has done a lot of work on setting bounds for circuit cutting, learning separations between classical and quantum machine learning, which things can you learn quantumly and which ones can you not. That's a lot of things. And then there's me. I wanted to highlight this because I think a lot of these works are really objectively one of the first that came out of Aqua. And if you're interested in visiting, joining, just let me know, okay? There's plenty of opportunities if this is something you would like to pursue further. So why am I there? Because I think what I do is not so much Aqua, but more ACK, which is algorithms applied to quantum instead of applied quantum algorithms. Because my research mostly is machine learning for quantum systems, whereas the other thing is more quantum for machine learning. Here's a few examples. In particular, maybe hopefully all of you have met Felix. And I was not going to talk about Felix's work, but then Yizhuang Yeo's talk yesterday on variational autoencoders and emergent classicality from a bottleneck, I thought this would be an interesting sort of companion to that. So let me spend three slides on what Felix did, and then we'll move on. Felix has made a data set, which is a very simple proof of concept idea, okay? So Felix makes this simple quantum circuit, which is parameterized by an angle alpha. So if you just look at these two gates, what comes out of this circuit would be a state that's either entangled for any non-zero alpha, or for zero alpha as separable, okay? And then we locally scramble them with unitaries, drawn from a higher measure, if you're interested. We do that for a whole bunch of alphas and for, I think 1,000 different unitary scramblings. And then Felix encodes those with a variational autoencoder that I'm not going to introduce in detail. Look at the paper if that's not familiar. I'm hoping that you maybe remember that from yesterday's talk. And then you can plot and interpret, hopefully, at least you can plot them, these latent representations. The way this machine learning, let's call it an AI for now, internally represents these density matrices. And if nothing else, you can make art. Okay? You can plot these internal representations, see what they look like. And then, that's not, clearly there is some structure, but it doesn't really tell us what this machine learning routine is doing. So the question we're asking it is, here's a bunch of density matrices. I will give you, let's say, one or two scalars that you can choose to represent this data set, or each sample, okay? Which scalars do you pick that give you the most information about that data set, okay? I give you this 4x4 density matrix, and I tell you one number that you can extract from each of them, and that should allow you to reconstruct this density matrix as best as you can. It turns out that it requires some more tuning with this beta parameter. This beta parameter gives you a way of saying how important is the representation versus how small your representation is. And I won't spend too much detail on that, but what you see here on the y-axis is this beta, and on the x-axis you see Felix gave this machine the option of actually not two, but eight scalars. And the colors here indicate how many of those scalars this machine actually uses to represent this data. And you see that there's quite a large regime where it just uses one number, and that regime corresponds to this plot. So the plot here shows two latent variables, zero and z1, but it's clearly linear related, so one suffices. And then we ask, what is that number? That one number that this machine is extracting, and it turns out to be the concurrence, which is a measure for the entanglement of this two-qubit state. So that if you plot this one latent variable versus concurrence, you get a very nice linear relation. This inset just shows that this one latent variable, that this is the loss of that machine, that model. One, going to more than one, two, or three really doesn't do anything. Okay, so this I thought was a very interesting sort of also philosophical point in the same sense as what Yijuan Guo was talking about, because we as humans think, you know, we know about entanglement as a good representative quality for whatever this two-qubit circuit did. And it could have been that there was some other non-interpretable or some other number that this AI found to represent them. It doesn't, okay? So concurrence makes sense. If you want to know more, look at the paper or talk to Felix. Back to the not-so-quantum carpool. And I said I was going to keep this very light, so I'm not going back to the quantum carpool yet, because it's Friday morning and there was a social yesterday, so let's do something a little bit fun, hopefully. And that maybe also, I don't know if you've consciously noticed, there was Mario in the background the whole time. You may have wondered why he was there. And the reason is there is because I think you should care about games and quantum games in particular. And quantum games, I talked about, I think, 4 or 5 years ago when I was here in the same position. And since then, we've revamped and made more games. But since then, I think we've also come to realize that this is a very interesting thing to pursue for different reasons. One is, let's say we all collectively managed to build a quantum computer in 20, 30 years. Then we're going to need people who have a better intuitive understanding of quantum and can work with those. And so we would want to start with, you know, the generation that in 20 years is ready, which means we're talking about kids. What better way to get kids and adults excited than through games? I'm hesitant to ask this, but how many of you play games? Anything. This includes 2048 on your phone or Candy Crush or whatever, right? It doesn't have to be PlayStation, Xbox, 3D, full-on graphics, right? Okay. Almost all of you, I think, if I saw correctly. Globally, that's about 40% of the population. I think if you look at Northern America and Europe, it's more like 70%. And it's uniform. It's not just one demographic that plays games. It's basically anyone, randomly picked 70%. You know, that's a good way to reach people and to build awareness that maybe quantum is more than just quantum computing also. That's a different topic. The other thing they do is, that's what I'm hoping, is that we can use them to drive quantum hardware. Like classical video games made GPUs work, right? And now we use GPUs for other kinds of things too. But I don't, you know, when I buy a new phone, I'm not going to do faster phone calls or faster WhatsApp, right? I mean, the thing that is increasing there is because I want to do, you know, next thing I want to do is AR, VR with my phone, right? So the same thing I hope we can use as an argument for driving hardware, because no hardware provider currently, correct me if I'm wrong, is anywhere close to providing real-time access, okay, which I would want to have for a game, let alone support, you know, thousands of people playing the same game at the same time. And the other thing is that these games, you know, while fun, can also be a very useful framework for doing serious research. And I say that, what I have in mind is both as a benchmark for hardware companies, but in particular, when thinking about building AI systems for such games. Right? If these games, the ones I'm talking about, are equivalent to running a circuit, now I can think about making an AI that does that samples the circuit, but maybe it's more efficient if I build an AI that itself is a circuit, like a plug-and-play AI whose sampling gives me actions that I should choose. And many, many more things that are interesting, I think, if those games are circuits. And I say that because those games and circuits have a lot of structure. Right? They come from particular types of moves that you make in the game. So they're different from other types of algorithms. Okay. End of pitch. If you're interested over coffee and you haven't talked to someone you wanted to talk to yet, invite them, challenge them to a game of tic-tac-toe. It's still in beta, it's almost done. This is the same one if you were here 4 years ago or 5 years ago, you would have seen. It looks different now, a little bit more professional. Let me do two players. This just runs on your device also, okay. It sends off circuits to a server. It runs on hardware. It doesn't run on hardware real time. There's a database it fetches results from and then submits those results to the server to run, and then it's in a queue and updates those that database. The only thing you will see would be, I think it's currently set to a simulator. You can select hardware in the start. This is tic-tac-toe, as you know it. Who doesn't know tic-tac-toe? Good. The other thing you can do in this game is you can drag and drop. And I just tell you, this is a game. It has a bunch of new rules. You all know that there's quantum behind this, but this is something you can show your nephew or niece and say, here's tic-tac-toe, and just has a bunch of new moves without having to understand what is going on in the background, right? You can do those moves. You can just do classical moves. You can also entangle squares. You can do more funky things. Right? And I'm not going to tell you what these things mean. You should play and find out. But once the board is full, what happens is that each of those qubits, actually each square is a qubit, not a qubit, is measured. And the game keeps going until there's a winner. And interestingly enough, classical tic-tac-toe is always a tie if you play optimally. If you, in this game, go for minimal quantumness, which only allows you to do superpositions, no entanglement, the starting player can always win. There's a challenge for you. See if you can figure out what that strategy is. And for the other two, I won't tell you the answer. Have fun with that. Play with it. Send me any bugs you find. You can play. You can invite a friend, send them a code on WhatsApp, and see if you can break the game. There's a tutorial there if you want to know more. Any questions in the meantime? Good. But then finally, let's get to the quantum carpool. Questions about the quantum carpool should go to Kai, because Kai is the PhD student in Cologne working with Simon Trapst on this project. This was started a few years ago in a very different format than what it is today. This project has changed shape many times over the year. It's still work in progress, but I think we're getting to a point where it's becoming a useful thing to talk about and compare. Who of you know the carpool problem? Most people. Okay, so this is the classical reinforcement learning benchmark, where you have a cart with a pole on top, and that pole obviously is going to fall over, and you get to push the cart to try and balance that thing. It's like having your hand in the stick and trying to balance that, right? You also go game over if the cart goes out of bounds. So in a sense, it's also a game, okay? That's not the point of the carpool, though. But every step in time, I give you these observables, the position, the velocity, and the angle and angular velocity. And based on that, you get to choose if you push the cart left or right, and with some predetermined set of forces. And every time step you do that, and in every time step where you don't go game over, you get a you know, plus 1 point. And your goal is to have as high a score as possible, which means keeping this card pull stable for as long as you can. Is that clear? Good, I see nodding. Fundamentally, I don't have to switch to this, but I'm going to do it for later, but the same instability of falling over, you can mimic, many people do that, by just this classical equivalent of a ball on top of a hill that rolls off to either side, and you need to push it back and back up and try to keep it on top of the hill, okay? So here, it's a little bit easier to describe because you just have position and velocity of this ball. You do the same thing where you apply a force to the ball, and the game over condition is just, you know, if it rolls off too far off hill, then you go game over. All of these systems, also the full card pull, there's optimal control theory, and these are very easy to control and stabilize under some assumptions. Mostly, the most important one is that you assume that that ball or that the pole starts out close to upright or close to the center, and it doesn't go very far off, right? At least in the initial state. If that's the case, you can linearize the equations of motion so that the state at t plus 1 is the state at t, and just a simple matrix multiplication. And if you can do that, and then I don't want to go through the whole theory of this control, the idea of linear control is that you add this control field u of t, which is also a linear, you know, linear control on the input. So you plug this in here, and then you determine for s of t plus 1 is such that x is 0, in this case on the top of the hill, and x dot is 0, stationary. You can relax this last one a little bit. It's fine if it's moving, more or less, but yeah. And so there's some linear algebra and some equation solving involved. But it's not difficult, and you can prove based on some of the properties of this control matrix that you can always stabilize this perfectly. Right? And if you do that numerically, you get a perfect curve. It starts, it's not so important what the scale is here, but it starts somewhere off of center, but still close enough that it's sort of linearizable, and you stabilize this forever. Let's try to break that and see how far we go with making this classical controller insufficient for control. So we can make it a little more difficult by not giving the controller the information of where the ball is currently moving, right? If you see the ball is rolling off to the left, then obviously you want to push it right. So in this case, what happens if I just give you a snapshot, from which you cannot tell if it's rolling off to the left or back up the hill, then this linear controller doesn't work. You need to do something more, because what's missing obviously is that velocity. But if you have a one-step memory and you know the previous picture, you can just estimate or infer where it was rolling, right? So that means you need to have some way of looking back into the past, and a way, or the de facto standard way of doing that, is with a Kalman filter, which is a linear quadratic estimator. So that just says, I have a way of estimating the current state in time based on what the previous step was, one step back, okay? So this linear quadratic estimator looks back in time, estimates the current state now, and then this linear quadratic regulator, which was the thing I showed on the previous slide that works if it's, you know, this linear equation, you can use that then to do the control, okay? Clear? So you have this backward-looking thing, which is estimating the current state, and then you have another controller that predicts what the next step is, and based on that, tries to choose the right control. Okay, let's try and make that even worse by adding noise. And there's two types of noise we can add. We can add a noise to the state estimate. Right, so there's actual noise on where what the current state is, or in addition, there's measurement noise. So instead of giving the controller s of t, this should be y of t, we're going to give it y of t, which is some transformation of the current state, but also with some extra noise. This is the measurement noise. Right? So I cannot actually measure the state, I get some noisy version of it. And you can still control everything as long as you know what the covariances are of these noises and these noise terms, and as long as those are Gaussian white noise processes, okay? Mean of zero, and then some covariance matrix. So in all of what I'm going to say, if you don't know these, if you have an unknown environment in that you're trying to control, this may not be the best thing to do. That's when we're going to move to reinforcement learning. Okay, that's what the comparison I would want to make, just for you to have an idea of where we're going. And so in that setting, this combination of this linear quadratic estimator and the linear quadratic regulator, that thing is called the linear quadratic Gaussian controller. And if you look at modern standards for control, for satellites, for anything, this is the thing that's being used. Okay. For classical control problems, this really is the workhorse in controlling. And it's this, there's more to it than what I'm just showing in terms of all kinds of bells and whistles, but this is the core, the backbone. And this is just a sample. Again, I'm not showing you any numbers on the y-axis here because it depends on the strength of the noise. But this controller is still optimal in the sense of average performance, okay? You might just get unlucky and you have some noise peak that completely gets you out of any controllable regime. But on average, the trajectory becomes much more noisy, but on average, it's pretty good at keeping it centered, okay? So it's optimal in that average sense. And these are all very simple things to implement, okay? So now you may wonder, okay, what if I have the chance of just doing more measurements? I'm looking back only one step into the past. What if I can do more estimates backwards? And of course, then for this simple system, everything is Markovian, and looking back further doesn't help you. But in general, perhaps you could. For this case, again, for these simple systems, the way we've set this up is that you measure, but as you measure, you cannot stop time and measure. So every measurement costs some time, so you measure while the system is evolving. And that means that as long as you're measuring more and more, you're getting a better estimate in a stochastic noise situation, but you don't actually do better because it costs you time, okay? You measure, and that in that measurement time, your ball rolls off further, and you're constantly running behind the fact that you're trying to measure. Okay, so in this case, you would get n measurements and apply a force, and that's doesn't really work. This came up in maybe in one more go. So there's one thing I didn't discuss yet, which is this being able to linearize the problem, and making it nonlinear actually. Also fine, okay? That's not an objectively bad thing to do. It makes things worse, but there's this extended Kalman filter which basically tries to linearize around the current estimate, okay? That's the most naive thing you think of, but it works well. And so we also tried a few different potentials that are, of course, the quadratic one is very easy, but quartic and cosine. I'm not going to discuss the cosine much more. I just wanted to show you that we also have data on that. Those are obviously less linear, and the problem, it does worse on these, but it still does that. So it's just an example of if this were the quadratic case, then this estimate, the orange curve, would essentially be perfectly on top of the rest. If it's not linear, then you see it has issues with estimating because this extended Kalman filter doesn't do perfectly. But it's still pretty good, and you can control your system with that. Here you see, maybe I didn't show that in the previous slide. So what I'm showing here is this, just measured in units of number of time steps, essentially, how long you manage to control on average. Okay. This obviously depends on the strength of the force you're allowed to apply and all of this, but this is just this is the scale that you should have in mind, 4,000 time steps. Compared to infinite if you had the other non-noisy case. So you see, it becomes a little worse for these other cases. This one's pretty good, but yeah. And so then a lot of this was based off of this paper, which is, I think, a few years old already, 2016, if I'm not mistaken. And they introduced this idea of a quantum cartball, where now, instead of having your classical ball on top of a hill, you just have a quantum particle on the hill. And the game over condition is when some percentage, let's say 50% of your total probability of your wave packet goes outside of some of the bounds. Okay, I hope that's intuitively clear. Here's this idea of how do you control such a problem, because if you measure it, you collapse it, so you have to do weak measurements. Okay, so that's what we're going to do, and I just wanted to, as a disclaimer, say that yes, I know that there's a lot of quantum optimal control problems out there. There's GRAPE, CRAB, all kinds of other acronyms. Those are almost all gradient-based, and they work well if you have a Hamiltonian description of your system. If you go to and they work well and get you to local minima. If you go to stochastic systems where you have measurement back action, those don't actually perform that well. Okay. Which is why reinforcement learning is such an interesting alternative. That's what I'm going to focus on for a little bit now. So I hope this gets over here. There's just the inverted harmonic oscillator. Of course, we also do the quartic and the cosine for this. And the force that you apply here is not an actual force, it's not the classical force, it's this kick operator, which is like applying a force. It's like a momentum delta that you do. In the paper, they do an equivalent thing of having a linear potential that you can tilt, which is gives you the same thing. Right. So here's the setup for this work, for this scenario. You now have weak position measurements, and I'm not going to explain what weak measurements are, and just beyond saying that for weak measurements you have an ancillary system that you couple for some time to your measurement, to your system you're trying to control, and you do projective measurements on that ancillary system. Okay. That will affect your system, of course, that you're trying to control with measurement back action, but it allows you to get little bits of information of your quantum state and distributions, essentially. We've hard-coded this in the sense that the measurement process is weak position measurement, weak momentum measurement, and that repeats. Okay? We've done a whole bunch of different things in alternating them or doing five position measurements and then five momentum measurements. None of it matters. Okay. What may matter, and that's something for later, is if we can make this agent, in a moment that I'll discuss, more autonomous and have the agent decide what to measure, how strong to measure, when to measure. Okay. But that's not what we're doing. We're hard coding the measurements for now and seeing what this agent can do with it. So the input to the agent, which will be for the expert's principal policy optimization agent, some type of reinforcement learning agent, will get the averages of those weak measurements. Okay? So the more weak measurements, the better you can estimate these averages, but you'll see there will be the same sort of trade-off. Compared to that, to the paper I showed, what we do is, because we do this PPO measurement, in the paper they have a discrete set of forces the agent can choose from. Here we just do continuous, okay? Up to some maximum force strength. The agent can do any continuous force in that range. I just have two more things that I want to show you. And both of these are work in progress, but I hope that they give you the idea of what this is going to lead to. There's a little information overload here. We train this reinforcement learning agent in two different scenarios. But let's focus on the classical case first, in the quadratic potential. It's still converged. This is an average, or the best case of, I think, 48 different agents. And these curves will look smoother at some point, but the trend, I think, is very clear. Also for the classical quadratic case, it's more measurements don't help. But interestingly, if you go to more nonlinear potentials, you get to see this bump, okay? Go ahead. Yes, excellent point. I didn't say, if you don't measure, there's no chance. If it's just unitary evolution and the forces, it will delocalize and nothing happens. You need the measurements to sharpen your wave function. Is that what you're asking? Doing the measurement alone will give you a longer control time than doing nothing. But having the measurement alone and a kick operator does better. You still get the benefit of doing the kick. Yeah. If you do very strong, it depends on the strength. If you do very strong measurements, you're just Zenoing, and then that's a different regime, right? But this is not the regime that we're in here. Yeah. We do them weakly enough that the measurement alone is not sufficient to stabilize for long times. Yeah. Trying to give you a bit of the overview and all the details we can discuss later if you'd like. This bump appears it's interesting because here this trade-off is very visible, right? There is a optimal number of weak measurements where you get a better estimate of the quantum state. And with that better estimate, you do better than if you had fewer measurements. But having more measurements is worse again, because then you lose the ability to control, to react to your system. Was there another question? Okay. And so that's in all these regimes. What you're seeing, so here this is the RL agent trained on the quantum problem. This, I should have said, is the classical problem. This is the particle on the hill with Gaussian noise, where the covariance of that noise is chosen to mimic the quantum case. Okay. So the weak measurements give you, if you have a wave packet, the weak measurements give you an uncertainty. It tells you, gives you a mean of that measurement, but then it gives you an uncertainty of some sigma, some Gaussian packet, sigma squared. And that sigma squared is the variance we use in the classical case, okay? So this classical case really mimics as close as we can the quantum version, which for a single particle, you can do. The middle column shows what the agent trained in the classical case does on the quantum system. We can discuss that, but I think the most important ones are these two. Now let's compare that to the red curve, which is the classical controller. Okay. Really, we know that for the classical, quadratic, super easy case, that red curve should be the best there is, because there you can prove everything is optimal. Okay. Surprisingly, somewhat, in a sense, if I hadn't told you that this classical system and the quantum case are essentially identical because of the stochasticity, also here, the classical agent is still better. And we can probably, if we make the agent better, larger, bigger, reach that point. And I say probably, I know that we can. We have a different agent. We have different things that we've tried in replacing either the estimation part with the reinforcement learning agent or the control part with the reinforcement learning agent. What you're seeing in the black curve is everything reinforcement learning agent. But of course, you can also do the Kalman estimate and feed that Kalman estimate to your agent, and then it already does better than this. Okay. But this is full-blown everything reinforcement learning agent. There's no classical controller for the mixed case because that's exactly the same here. Here, you start to see already that there's this intermittent regime where your reinforcement learning agent can do better than the classical controller. And there's different ways, I think different reasons that we can discuss on why that is. But that's the current status, okay? I think I'm nearing the end, and that's perfect timing. So more on this soon, hopefully, but the takeaways that I would want to leave you with is that this classical controller, this de facto thing that's being used in industry for controlling much more complicated complicated systems than we've been discussing here, using weak measurements actually does a pretty good job controlling a simple quantum system. Okay? And you really need to go to nonlinear cases, and I didn't show you, but if you add different types of noise to these systems, then this reinforcement learning controller really seems like a useful idea. And I didn't mention that that paper I showed really tries to profile this as a benchmark thing. So I'm sure that hopefully we can contribute this as another way of doing that benchmark. If you don't know the noise or the covariances of your system, all of these things, then of course this classical controller is out, and reinforcement learning is a good choice. I'm not trying to say that we should replace reinforcement learning with the linear controller. I'm just saying that this linear controller is actually pretty good by itself already, the classical one. So that means it's coffee time. And that's also a good chance for me to point out this same QR code again, if you want to play tic-tac-toe during coffee and talk to someone you haven't talked to and see if you can beat them at a game of tic-tac-toe. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Eva, for this perfect Friday morning lecture. Let's talk.
Thank you for a great talk. I was wondering, so there's a bunch of other different flavors of classical control that people are looking into other than just Kalman filters and linearizing around proper minima. For instance, the one I always thought would play best with quantum problems would be model predictive control, where you would kind of sort of learn the Hamiltonian or some governing equations of the system and then just kind of simulate it as far as you can and try and play with it. This is clearly outside of the scope of your slides, but I was just wondering if your thoughts about this as a broader, as a different approach to the same problem.
Yeah, no, I think, so this is a very interesting point that we're obviously also trying model predictive control using. So if you have a Hamiltonian controlled system without this weak measurement, then that's a very straightforward thing to do, and it typically is a clever thing to do. Right? It's a more, I'm not sure what this is the right way of saying it, but it's optimal control also, quantum optimal control. My impression so far is that that's probably what you want to do if you can, but it's not sure. I'm not sure how we extend that or do that here with this stochastic scenario. If you have ideas, I'm very happy to exchange thoughts. Yeah, exactly. Great.
Thank you for the great talk. So I have actually a comment in regards to more the first part of it. When we talk about these kind of closed environments, like tic-tac-toe, so we typically have like a number of states which are accessible. And if this environment is large enough, we kind of build a tree of states, which, for example, Monte Carlo research agents are kind of those which tackle these problems well.
Yep.
It's interesting, actually, in the quantum case, if your environment is sufficiently large and you have actually a lot of, you play your game long enough, you probably should see kind of a scrambling transition here, because you will like not be able to like go all the tree down to the initial configuration. Yeah. Did anyone look at that?
Yeah, so we're trying very hard. So with tic-tac-toe, I classically limit the moves you can make. So you can never entangle more than three squares, which I'm not going to explain now, but which means practically that if you run these circuits, the largest circuits you run are 6 qubits, and of depth, I think 6 or 7, and they're always the same circuits. It's the same thing. So here you don't notice that. The other game is quantum chess, and I say this every time, but I'm still puzzled by it, because this idea of quantum chess is like taking a difficult game and making it even more difficult. So I'm not sure. You know, it's an interest. This is really a niche kind of thing. And we're, the AI we've made for that, okay, sorry, the AI for tic-tac-toe it's still doable with a minimax search. It's expecting minimax, because every time the board is measured, you need to evaluate all possible outcomes. So there's an averaging there. For chess, each square is a qubit, so there's 64 qubits. In a typical game of chess, you will not entangle more than, let's say, 20 at most, if you're just playing the game. If you're really trying to make everything entangled, you can, but And for those, the depth, the circuit runs out of bounds very quickly, and that all runs on the simulator. Tic-tac-toe actually runs on hardware. Quantum chess can run on hardware, but there, indeed, you notice that just you don't get far enough. That AI, to get to your question, for chess is also a tree search. So maybe that's also the reason why it doesn't get that far. But it's basically using known chess AIs and opening that up to include quantum moves. It's much harder than you may think, because there's no checkmate in quantum chess. You have to actually capture the king. And all of those classical chess engines don't know how to handle anything beyond checkmate, right? The checkmate is game over, which is not the case for quantum chess. So there's a, yeah. But this, so what we have, what I can give you, is a full database of all the games of quantum chess, and you can maybe see if this effect that you're describing of the scrambling happens. But if I make a business out of this, I'll make you pay for that.
Yeah. Maybe we have more questions. Roger, you have a mic.
Oh.
I'm wondering, do you have a feeling about this performance difference in a quantum case? Does it have to do with the weakness of your measurements? Like if you would go completely to the other side, that you measure more strongly, you project the wave function, is that this intermediate regime where you get an advantage, or you think you would also see that in a strong measurement cases?
No, I think you have the right intuition. If we go to stronger measurements, if you go to very strong measurements, then you get this, what Javier suggested, you basically go, you Zeno, you project it, right?
Yeah.
If you go to very, very weak measurements or weaker measurements, then you see this peak of optimality shift to more and more measurements for a given fixed time interval. And so that effect of taking the measurement strength up basically moves that peak into that continuous curve that you see for the classical controller.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah, you make it more close to the classical. So you, in a nutshell, yes, that's the right intuition. It's the measurement strength. Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And another question. Now to the second part of the talk. So if you want to make more efficient, like more efficiently to estimate the state of the quantum card pool, so can't we think about some kind of maybe quantum autoencoder here scheme, such that we probably need like less qubits to efficiently at least get some necessary information about that object, rather than measure all the wave function here.
Yeah, but I think that it sounds like that may be helpful or relevant, especially if you go to not something like this spatial system with a wave function, right? If you had a system that you describe as a discrete system with many qubits, is that what you're referring to? Because then I think that may help. Then you can do, then you have a circuit, right, that you can quantum auto-encode. And for that, I think that may be a good approach. That's also something for those three slides of what Felix has been doing, that we also want to try that with a quantum autoencoder, okay? Because it literally is a circuit. It's only two qubits, but you can make a larger circuit and do the quantum autoencoder on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting point, though. Yeah.
Good. If we don't have any further questions, then let's thank Ivar again.